John Caulfield here at the Town Hall in Talla. John, tell me your background first before we start. Where did you people come from?
Well, we are originally from Mayo, near Ballyhaunas. I came here to Firhouse School as a third assistant in 1955. It was just a little rural country school, Spaniel School. I was the first person to teach in the particular room, built on the grounds of the Carmelite nuns. And I've been here since. I came in 55 and I retired in 94.
What was your father doing? Was there a teaching tradition in the family?
Yeah, I'm the fifth generation teaching. My mother taught. Two of her sisters and one of her brothers were teachers. Both her parents were teachers. Granny's grandfather was a teacher, and one before him again, I believe, was a hedge school teacher.
Oh my goodness. So there's a long tradition teaching in the family.
In the family, yeah. And my daughter.
But from your maternal side, what about your father?
They were farmers. And he joined the Guards in 1922. His number was 2252. And he retired then, I don't know, sometime. He's dead since 1983.
But you grew up on a farm?
Well, no, not on a farm, but we had a couple of cows ourselves, pigs. We cut turf and did all the associated with the farm.
And your father was a part-time sergeant of police.
Well, yes. You could say he was a part-time farmer.
Yeah.
Oh, that station now slows down. So
what part of Mayo?
A place called Hollymount, between Ballinrobe and Claremorris.
Yeah,
I went to the Christian Brothers in Ballinrobe for my education.
And what was your own education like?
Well, my mother taught me, and Uncle Tom taught me. Then I went to the brothers, and it was a very happy now.
Yeah.
Very happy.
Was there special treatment?
No. Not from Uncle Tom anyway, but no, there wasn't, no.
Yeah.
And I would say maybe that Mum was a bit more strict on me than she would be on the other children.
Yeah. But having your mother teaching, I mean, that was a great break.
Yeah.
But you know, that area was very rustic and rugged, I suppose. So you were indeed growing up as you were a rural.
Oh yes.
Kid.
I've lifted oats, tied oats, turned hay, saved hay, picked potatoes. You know, thin turnips, which is a hard job.
Mm-hmm.
But I've done it all.
And what was it like then, you know, when you finished school, finding a job? How did you find your way over here? Your teaching career, did you go to St. Pat's?
I went to Pat's from 48 to 50 and then came out. It was very difficult to get jobs at that time. Now, it was just beginning to kind of loosen up, but it was difficult to get jobs. And my first job was in Top McConnell in Roscommon, a one-roomed school with myself and a lady called Eileen Finneran, who subsequently was related to Kevin Boland, our minister, and a very happy time there in Top McConnell. And then I got a job in Claremorris School, which would be like our local big town, at my father's insistence, really, and stuck it for 2 years and then I came up to Dublin. My son, my brother was in the bank here in Dublin, and I came up to visit him. Saw an ad for the school at Firhouse. Went out to Rathfarnham, met the late Monsignor O'Donnell, got the job, and I'm in Dublin since.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you were a young lad going out, you know, when you did finally get that job in Firhouse. Describe to me again. Now, I know you said it was very... Yeah. Different to what it is today. Nothing but fields and...
Yes. I had a scooter, a Vespa scooter. I drove out to Firhouse, cycled out to Firhouse, whatever you want to say. Left my bike at the side of the road. Didn't lock it. Never did. It was that, you know, it was just pure rural. And it was a little two-teacher school. And... Ballyroan Road then down in near to Templeogue was just being developed at that stage, and we had a good school, and we garnered a lot of the youngsters from that development.
So in fact, you came in at the right time.
I did.
You saw it growing and developing.
Oh, I saw it, yes. Yeah. We went from a four-teacher school to, I had 22 or 23 staff besides myself, teaching staff, before I retired.
But those very early days, John, when you arrived there teaching, you were teaching a two-room class?
I was teaching third and fourth class.
Yeah.
And it was tough. It was tough.
Why?
I came from in Clamorris, it was kind of brackwilted. Lots of Irish in it. Irish, to teach Irish was no problem. And you come up here to Dublin then, and it was just a chore. Nobody wanted to know about Irish at that stage. And that was, the children were nice, parents were lovely. But I had a happy old time in Fourhouse.
Yes, of course, but you learned very fast that Irish was something going to be difficult to teach in the classroom.
Yes, I did.
Did you?
I did. I'll tell you something interesting. I was talking to a parent one time, it was a few years in the school at the time, and she was talking about her son doing pass Irish and pass English. And I said, there is no such thing as pass Irish, ma'am. There's no such thing as pass English. There's just Irish. And we had a great argument. When we went to the brothers, we did Irish. We got a pink paper. It was an honest paper. We didn't know it. And the same was for the English. We didn't even know there was such a thing as a pass. So we knew there was honors maths and pass maths. But shows our country ignorance.
Imagine. Yeah. And the this was the 50s now we're talking about, isn't it? When you
would
came
be,
in.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And living with corporal punishment and all. It was a different way of teaching, wasn't it?
It was. It was, and while, you know, I've been trying to say the cane has its place, but I see the children growing up today, they have no discipline, there is no punishment. If a child does wrong, you don't give them lines, you have the mothers in saying, you give them something better to do than lines, you know, it just doesn't work. And I think there should be some kind of a sanction that the children will know I do A, B is going to be the result, that B would be the point. Not necessarily a few wallops if you can, but I do think that it should be no harm.
Did you have uniforms in the school?
No.
In the early days? Any days? No.
I didn't have a uniform in the school. Now, ours was a mixed school too, which was very, very, very unusual to have. At one stage, 12-teacher school, mixed. And I believe that there was a movement on to have it done into two schools. But the Archbishop died before that happened. That was Dr. McQuaid. But I don't know how true it is, but the rumour was out. But we didn't have a uniform because, well, number one, I didn't grow up with uniforms. We didn't. The kind of the school just grew. And I always found with the little kids, you know, they'd be shy and crying the first day in, and maybe the first week or 2 weeks in. Just say, I love your dress. It is beautiful. Big smile, you're her friend forever. And certainly that might be an argument for uniforms, but, or against uniform, but yes.
Yeah.
And
that's interesting.
Then my successor straight away into uniform.
Yeah.
But I don't resent it.
That was your
new
way,
man.
That's the way you did it.
Yeah.
Okay, now that's one interesting point. But in the classroom itself, you know, you were teaching very young people, you know, that were just emerging in a society here that was developing very quickly around them, and lots of changes. How did you find that time?
In 1967, I became principal of the school. So that took me out of the classroom straight away. So I wouldn't have the problem with discipline of the fifth and sixth class fellows or the indiscipline. But I always kept very close to the parents. It was Mary and Delia and everybody else. I was on first name terms with them, which I found was a better approach than Mrs. and Mr. Although, one time I said to some lady, would you tell Mrs. Whitsey, Mrs. Caulfield, I want to see you for a minute. And she says, who's Mrs. Caulfield? I said, after walking in the door with her. And she, oh, Mary, I never knew her name was Caulfield.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like, that was a happy, happy school. It really was.
Yeah. But what made the difference, I suppose, is you were contacted. You kept in close contact with
very
the parents.
Close, yeah.
And did you find the kids like sponges soaking up the, you know,
yes.
that they were
yes.
quick
if,
to learn?
If you had a good teacher, yes. A lot depended on the teacher.
Were you lucky with teachers in the school?
Oh, yes, I was. Don't say it, I was ruthless also. Yeah, I engineered that a lot of people would move on if they weren't. But we had a good school and a very happy school. But, you know, kind of...
No, there were a lot of changes in the way schools are run. There was an openness, you know, that the children could wander around and
yes.
they could play
yeah.
in the yard.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah.
Can you just tell me, now looking back at that in those years, did you find that that was a good thing to do, to let them wander around, let them, you know, play freely in the yard?
Well, we were lucky. We had about a rood of grass at the side of the school when I came there first, where we had football matches, and we had leagues going all during the summer. We had football leagues for the children, and the girls, when they play, whatever girls play, you know, when I it came to me then that later on when I was a walking principal, that the kids don't do hopscotch or skipping or anything like that anymore. So I decided, well, we'll try and introduce it back. And we got, you know, those chants, the farmer wants a wife, and all those. And I used to go out in the yard with them. I felt an awful fool, really, at times. But I used to go out there and play with them. And you wouldn't do it now because you'd be put down as some kind of a dodgy character. But we used to go around there and we play the farmer wants a wife. And it was, and we sang our songs and... is a brown girl in the something rather than the sun. I remember seeing them singing that at the top of their voices.
Yeah.
We had a,
And that created an atmosphere too, didn't it?
It did.
It kind of broke down any barriers that was there.
Yeah. And then the parents helped me. We had, our long corridor was about 70 yards long with about maybe 24 windows in it. And we had three geranium plants on every single window. It was a nice school. And then we had, at one stage, right across the front of the school, there was a plot of clays for a flower bed. But we decided we would try a vegetable garden. And luckily enough, Miley Wilson, who had a dairy farm, lived next door, and he had just given it up, and there was his old manure heap was there. So we were to get all the fertilizer. And we grew potatoes and all the vegetables for a few years. And then one time we went home on Friday, came back on Monday, found every single thing we had pulled up, you know, just vandalized. That was the first time now that that kind of thing happened to us in Farhouse. But when the girls did needlework, that was it, and I took the lads to the bit of gardening. So in ways, I suppose, maybe it was before my time.
Well, it was showing them how
yeah,
things grow.
Yeah, we loved it, and they loved
that
it.
That was interesting. But within the school, you said that you played football, Gaelic football?
Yeah, Gaelic, yeah.
Was there soccer and rugby? Or
no, just Gaelic. But the pitch was too small for it. It was all Gaelic, yeah. And then we had, there was a school, Rory McGee was in Lindismole, and he had a team. Pete Sullivan was over in Newcastle. These are Prince's schools there, and we had a little league. There was a cup or something going. We never were lucky enough to win it, but it was great. It was great. And one young fella, Pat West, he's very prominent St. Anne's, do you know, born at Breena. He was a little fellow, a beautiful footballer, but small and hadn't great sight. But he was doing a solo run up along the wing. And he sort of run right over the end line. And he let us swear at him. So a little fellow in sixth class of 12.
Did you have your own jerseys in the school?
We had blue and yellow. Yes, I don't know where they came out. And we even had our own crested little pine tree, green pine tree sort of in a back, green background.
Where did the idea come from?
We had a teacher then, John Noonan. I'm quite sure he selected the colours too. And the little crest. I don't know whether they have it now or not. See, the school then was divided later on into a junior school and senior school. Around about 78 and 80. Mm-hmm. It was divided into a junior school and a senior school. And the senior school was built over at the shopping centre in Forhouse. And I stayed on with the junior
oh, I see.
Kids.
And did the curriculum change that much in your time there?
It did. I remember an inspector come in one time with some, I know the teachers are inspectors from Europe. And he was in our class and says to me, "What teaching aids have you?" I says, "Blackboard and a chalk is all we have here." And we went from that then. Now they have the computers and we had television. We got we raised funds then by showing films once a week. A fella used to come and put on a show for us, and I think we divided the profits. But we raised a lot of funds like that then. Yeah.
Who used to do the films? Was
some private guy. He went around to schools.
Yeah.
And that helped us to buy, at that time, tape recorders.
Yes.
And that was the big thing. And then we got some TVs. And the mums used to record the BBC schools programs for me. I'd give a woman a blank VCR and she would record, we'd say, half an hour every morning and bring it back in and we showed them to the children.
Well, that was such a change from your early days. What did you do with the tape recorders? What was the purpose of...
We got into remedial teaching in a big way. And we had a brilliant remedial teacher, Mrs. Cuss Kelly. And she had put us on to the use of... You'd use them for, children with speaking difficulties. We got a Canon one that had kind of a... What would you call it? An everlasting tape in it. And the child would read whatever they wanted and then they'd be able to listen to it again. And
yeah.
Yes.
Did you find them helpful?
Oh, we did, yeah. Yeah.
And it brought the kid on quite fast, did it?
You know? Well, it brought them on anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
But what about the local history in the place? You mentioned earlier, I think, that the school is sitting on a very important site.
Yes, I only found that out after I retired. George Moore, who came from Moore Hall, bought Tymon Lodge for one of his... Is paramour the right word? His girlfriend. She was an artist. And who exhibited at the RHA in I don't know if it's Ireland or at London or Dublin. But she was an artist of note. And in his book, Hail and Farewell, he has some very fine descriptions of the house. It was subsequently knocked when they built Carriglee and Woodlawn Park, razed to the ground. And I would love to get Time Team or something to come in, you know, that program on the telly, to come in and dig it up, because I'm sure there are... what do you call them? Cellars in that of the place yet, but it's gone.
And is there any drawing, illustration of what it looked like in those days?
No.
No. You know, it's.
When I came to Four House, it was called. They didn't call it Tymon Lodge, T Y M O N, but the locals called it Tymon Lodge, And the avenue up to it was all overgrown with briars and this, that and the other. So I never went up to see the house in my time. And it was only subsequently to my retirement that I've discovered that it had such a great connection with Mayo, number one, me being a Mayo man, and with George Moore, number two. Yeah. And in that book of his, Hail and Farewell, he has a description of Scotch fir trees he sowed at the entrance. And when I left Fir House, there'd be about maybe six or eight of those trees left. They have a new entrance put in there now. There are still one or two of the trees left. I don't know how many are there, but certainly some of them are gone.
It doing something like that actually changes the whole look of the place as well, and then it takes away part of its history, part of what it was.
Yeah.
But there's no trace of the building now, and
no trace.
What about the place name itself? Would there be a lot of fir growing in the area? Fir House.
Well, now if you look up Domville Hancock's book. He says it came from a Fira family, F-I-E-R-A-G-H, that they owned the inn there, the Fir House Inn. Maybe it was, I don't know. There was never any, no, there aren't any Fir House, or fir trees around Fir House.
Yeah.
I said that categorically. And also in Fir House, we have the Weir, which was built around about 1200. I should have looked all this up before I come up to you.
Yeah.
And it was built to divert the waters of the Dodder into the city, and that was the first water supply in Dublin. And that weir, and if you get up and look at the weir, you can see it's built kind of by its ways across the river, so that the force of the current pushes the water down to.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
But was any of that taught to the
kids in the school? Oh yes.
And it gave them a sense of place.
Oh, it would. Yes. Ah, yeah. That would be in the local knowledge thing too, and And there were 18 mills, I think there were paper mills, from Fir House up to Old Bourne Bridge. And again, you can see here and there, if you look along the river, you'll find little things, traces of them. There is a diversion of a stream at the Fir House Bridge for a paper mill that was there, right beside it.
Is there any trace of any old roadway going by or
now,
near?
In the linear park opposite the Ballyboden St. Enda's, there's what you might describe as a double hedge going straight across the grounds of the linear park, which I am quite sure was the old road, because the bridge across the river at Temple Oak was built in 1798. But previous to that, you crossed the Dodder by a ford farther on. And I am certain sure that that's what that road is. Now, that's my own gut feeling that is what that old road is.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, you know, in the time you were there, you took a genuine interest in the local history.
Oh, I did. Yes, there was a house called Delaford, and the Fir House Road ran by his front door. It was a Bianconi. A hotel thing, and then to subsequently sold to a fellow called Birmingham, and he didn't like the coach road in front of his front door, so he just simply built a big round detour the road, and that was that. And Delaford now is gone. That house is gone.
Yeah.
And Dave Allen is supposed to. He lived in Cherryfield House. It was a pink house in on the football fields there, which is again knocked. And he's reputed to have to come to Fir House School, but I looked in the school records and there's no trace of Dave Allen. But I know a lady who would say Dave Allen was in her class. And it wasn't Dave Allen, he was a Tynan O'Mahony, Dave O'Mahony was his name.
Yeah.
And incidentally, in the school, we have school registers that go back to the 1800s. And you can see the names of the children admitted, 2 years old, 2.5 years old, 3 years old. It was a kind of a glorified, the Carmelite nuns ran the school then, and it was a babysitting service for the mill workers.
It's a
very interesting book. And the copperplate writing of the...
And Just leading on from that, was it also in any way a place of refuge for unmarried women with babies?
No.
That was never the case.
No, because the farmer's the father's name and occupation is
only
in the register.
Yeah.
And you see mill worker or labourer or different people like that.
Yeah, interesting.
It is.
Those records would give you names as well. Did you find that those names kind of continued on?
Oh, yes, you had Lawlers, Lawlesses, Bagnalls, yes, Carrolls. There's a family called Carrolls in Old Court. And as far back as I can go, there's a Carroll in the school.
And you know that in itself would tell you that the family lived on there in the area for all that time.
Yeah.
And you know the because Temple Oak really wasn't even was just a tiny village.
It was only a village. It was just a little village. All the houses, the far side of Temple Oak, down as far as Bushy Park, on either side there was nothing there except fields. And up Cypress Grove, you know, when you cross the bridge, all that was fields.
Yeah.
Some of that was owned by the man, I think his name was Gallagher. He owned, or he started Orney, the Orney sweet factory here in Talla.
And that brought a lot of people in this direction. Where were they coming from? I mean, you'd have a good idea now from the early 50s, or the late 50s, onwards towards the 60s and 70s. Where were the children's parents coming from? That had, you know, there were blow-ins.
Yeah, they were all from everywhere. You name it. There's a man, Aben Hunt. He was baptised and confirmed in the same church as myself, in Barnacarroll, near Knock.
That is a coincidence.
Isn't it?
That is incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were coming from
everywhere.
All over.
Yeah. There would be a lot of Dublin people in, but the country people, they were all purchase houses. You see, there were.
How do you mean now?
Well, I heard. Now, well, maybe this should be off the record. Two principals' wives arguing about their, and she says, "My husband hasn't a big corporation scheme in his place like your husband has." You know, this kind of cottage. But I could say we didn't have any. Four house was all
on one level, like it
all,
was.
They were all the one level. That's it. We're all the one safe social
status.
Status, yes.
But that was creeping in, was it? The kind of if you like climbing the ladder or trying to be better than the person beside you, your neighbour.
I read somewhere a person describes this place as people on the way up. People on the way down met people on the way up. No, Forhouse is very fine. It's a very fine community. I have very, very happy memories of it.
How long were you there?
39 years.
39 years.
Yeah.
All the time that you were there, you experienced different things as you were principal for all those years. You would, like we spoke about, all the different people from around the country coming and settling down, and all their children were educated there. What about language? And I don't mean Irish English. I mean the accents. Would you have noticed that in the kids? You know, the country accent, the Dublin accent.
Don't have any memory now, really. Because the kids would be like my own kids, they'd be all dubs.
All dubs?
I have a fellow in America and he has the thickest Dublin accent out. He's there for 21 years.
What about language as in bad language? Did you find that was relevant, you know, kind of there?
Well, it's more prevalent when I left than when I started.
Was it?
Oh, yes.
Was manners a little bit more the thing in the past than
young
it is now?
Oh, yes, very much so. Like when you came there first, all the children stood up in the classroom, you entered the classroom. God has arrived. That's gone now. They don't do that anymore. And I see, we're saying, like, going in and outdoors, the idea of standing back to let a lady through or anything like that. No. I tell you something that crossed my mind too. when the girls left our school in sixth class, they were able to knit a stocking or a sock, man's sock, turn the heel, knit gloves, how to patch a sheet. And that is a very intricate way of patching a sheet. And we're telling, we had a brilliant vice principal, Judy Davern, and she was into this in a big way, how to put a patch on a sheet. And I said to one, Judy, the way to patch a sheet is to cut it across the middle, tie the, sew the top to the bottom. She was horrified. It was undermining her work. But that was what the girls were able to do. And so, I don't know what the expression is. There's such a thing as a running fell seam, whatever that is. Mm. That was big doing it. And yes.
Yeah, well, these were the things taught that the girls were able to leave with.
Yeah.
Did you find that, now this is something I suppose that is very prevalent today, and that's being bullied in the classroom, being bullied in the yard.
Well, you know, it was a time of temporal or corporal bullying, not temporal punishment.
Maybe there could be that too.
Corporal punishment, and well, you dealt with them summarily. Now my daughter now is teaching in Westport, and she has she came across a problem of bullying on the day before yesterday. So she rang, Dad, what'll I do? So she brought in the parents, and I don't know, it's still ongoing. But
well, that was teacher student.
My daughter was, she's teaching there.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And she rang her dad rang me to see what would she do, what action should she take
about
the child that was being bullied
by a teacher.
No.
Oh, by another boy.
Three or four other boys.
Yes.
So yeah. I just suggest that she, number one, tell her principal teacher, mm-hmm. and number two, talk to the parents. Like in the good old days gone by, you bring them in, you give them four or six apiece, and that was it all over. Gerard Gale.
Yeah. But it was very, it was there, and it really... you know, it ruins some people's lives, because at a very early age, they, you know, when their personalities were being formed,
you know,
this bullying really stayed with it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. And in those days, and you'll remember this yourself, if you went home and said you got slapped, what did you do wrong? And you'd probably get a few more wallops from your father. Certainly I would, from your father, for not behaving yourself.
Was that a good or a bad thing, though?
I don't know. Because I was a strict father myself, and if I could get my time back again, I think I wouldn't be as strict as I was, but sure I wouldn't, but certainly, I don't know whether there was bullying that much in those times. There probably was, but certainly when it came up to notice, you just... Mm.
But was it always by the book, in your eyes?
The slapping?
No, the way that you conducted your work, you know, that everything was regimental and strict and to the
rules. Well, I tried to break that when I took over the school. I wanted the school to be a family school, you know, a happy family school. And I think we achieved it. And I can see now the girl is in charge of the school now, and she still has that nice happiness in the school.
Yeah. Just another interesting point about teaching. You know, you have to have a special kind of gift, I think, you know, to be able to play with children and handle children properly in teaching. Is this something that, do you find this with teachers coming into the classroom before you left in the later part of your life, that they didn't have that kind of
they
gift.
Did, yes. A lot of them did have. And you'd know. I used to say, there's no need for inspectors in this school. You just walk into the classroom, you know. You know before you open your mouth. The whole ethos, the whole thing in the classroom, you know immediately whether it's a good room or whether it's a good teacher. But the business of, we say, I think you were saying, was it a kind of a gift you have? I think it has to be cultivated, so you have to work on it. You probably have to have a certain... But, see, the doctors now are saying, to be a doctor, you must get a perfect leaving cert. Now Mary Hanavan is saying, to be a doctor, you must have the aptitudes to be a doctor. And I would say the same for teachers. Although we did have interviews, not that I come to think of it, before we went into PATS, we did have an interview. And they made up their minds. That was in the 1948 when I went in.
How big were the classes that you taught? I think you told me that you taught huge numbers initially.
Judy Davern, I mentioned her, she had 72 children in her class for 9 months. She had them sitting and standing. The reason for that huge number now, you know, it's like you think it's an exaggeration. It's not an exaggeration, because in those times, you had to have the average, we mentioned 36 there. We say, Judy started off, we'd say, with maybe 70 children, that the average you wanted to have, 72 children in the extra children in the class for 9 months before you allowed another teacher. 9 months you had to have it, three quarters. And if we say at the end of the second quarter, your numbers went down, or the third quarter, you wanted to, we'd say, 72 and you went down to 70, bingo, you didn't get your extra teacher. So that gave rise to huge classes. But even when I was in Four House, when I started off teaching, half the class sat down and they would, be doing maths. And the rest of the children would be standing up and we'd do reading or English reading or Irish reading or something that line. And then at the end of the half hour, the ones that were standing sat and the ones that sit and stood. So that's the way it went. But now there's a seat for everybody in the classes.
Yeah, but that was difficult, wasn't it? I mean, how could you possibly teach 70 children in a classroom, not to mind keep them quiet, keep them disciplined for that length of time?
I don't know.
But you managed.
We managed, yeah.
How many years did you do that? That went on for quite a few years, didn't it?
What did, yeah. I don't know the figures now, I just
yeah. Something else. And it didn't really change until you got an extension to the school, that would have been?
Yeah, when we started off with four schools, there are now four rooms, and there are now 16 rooms, and they have two prefabs also, and they have what were two cloak rooms also, so that you have 20 classrooms going in that school now. For some of them are for children, foreign children who don't have English. And
well, that's something now you've met with as well. I mean,
no, I never met that. That never happened to us.
But I know, but when did you retire? What year?
94.
So it really hadn't happened.
It hadn't happened.
Yeah.
But you come down now, yes, went to a class. I love going back to the school. I go back about every month or 6 weeks.
And, you can't let go.
I do, no. Well, no, it's not that I can't let go. I love to go back and see. Yeah. Orson now is the principal, and I love to go back and see, you know, why the heck didn't I think of that? You know, that's a great idea. But go into a classroom and half of them are foreign children.
Yeah.
And a thing we did have in our school, and my predecessor, Mr. Pender, started it, was travellers in the school. We always had travellers in our school. And it was, you know, and again, they integrated well. The only trouble with the travellers were that you'd have them and they'd be going grand, and then daddy decides, spring comes, it's time to go. And off they go to some other where. Come back again in the winter time.
It didn't matter about schooling.
Yeah, no, it didn't. Oh, no. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Were they easy? You know, you said they fitted in fairly well?
They did. Well, we wouldn't have that many of them. But they did. They fitted in grand.
Yeah.
And the kids, they accepted them.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about travellers nowadays, they're reasonably, they're settled enough. You know, they're beginning to, you know, they have. But
people are all down the Ballycullen Road.
Were they?
Yeah.
And they were O'Brien's Coffees or.
They were Cassidy's. I forget my own memory. certainly Cassidy's were lovely children. Mm. Lovely children. And. I forget the other names now, but they were, you know, they were nice and polite. And again, if a traveller child was out from school for any length of time, I got into my car and I drove to the caravan or the camp or wherever they were, and I says, where was I? And we'd have a chat, and kind of coax them. He didn't want to come or, you know, something else.
So you took your job very seriously.
Oh, I did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I did, yeah. I made it my business and I became principal to get into every kitchen of every child in the school. And, you know, just to go home with them.
Yeah,
And that's the way you get to know the people. And they get more important, they get to know you, you know, that you're not the master and kind of...
And looking back now on those 40 years, they were obviously very happy years in your life.
Yes.
And you miss it. You do if you keep going back, you do.
Well, not so much that I miss it. I'd feel disloyal to them if I didn't go back to see them from time to time.
Yeah. Because it's become part of you.
Yes,
isn't
it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it would be very hard if it didn't, or you'd be very different man if you didn't, because it, you know, with that involvement for all of those years, surely it did. It obviously took an effect on you. But Frank Caulfield, to have your story today was brilliant, and thank you. Sorry, did I say Frank? John Caulfield. It was lovely talking to you today. Thank you very much.